Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have come to admire greatly a man who is in the forefront of that war in the United States Senate. He is Senator Ron Johnson. He represents the people of the state of Wisconsin in the Senate and has been doing so now with considerable distinction, including in his role as the chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. He's also a member of the Committee on Foreign Relations. And in both of these capacities, he's played an incredibly important role on several topics that we'll be talking about with him today. Senator Johnson, welcome back. It's great to have you with us, sir.
Good morning, Frank. You can be assured it's a mutual admiration society here. I've been listening to you for a long time and learning a lot from you, so certainly appreciate your efforts.
Thank you. Well, let me start with Iran. You played an incredibly important role in the fulminations, I guess is a better way to describe it really than a debate about the deal that President Obama struck with Iran. I call it the Obama bomb deal. You were trying to have it considered as it should have been, as a treaty. You subsequently also tried to make sure that the Senate didn't fall prey to this idea that the president had been complying with the alternative, the Corker-Cardin bill. Talk a little bit about the process as it worked out and where you think we go from here on Iran.
Our greatest strategic failure there was that we didn't spend a lot of time driving home the point that President Obama, in his arrogance, was just treating something so important, so consequential, as a mere executive agreement, requiring absolutely no input from the American people through their elected representatives. This, for my mind, certainly was a treaty. Now, we did get a vote on my amendment that would have deemed it a treaty, but that, you know, the amendment was called up almost without notice. It failed immediately. Unfortunately, not every Republican even voted to deem this a treaty, which really did surprise me. Senator Corker is trying to get at least some congressional involvement in this deal, and he succeeded. But the problem is, the only involvement we could have was this vote of disapproval that the Democrats would have agreed if it was such a bad deal that we would have removed President Obama's waiver authority under congressionally backed sanctions. I realize that's complex and convoluted, and that was my point. We needed to provide clarity to this, and unfortunately, the only thing President Obama and Democrats would agree to was something incredibly convoluted and very weak. And let's face it, President Obama did not even comply with the deal that he signed just a few months before that to turn over all the parts, all the side deals, all the annexes. So we never did get the full information. It's bad enough with what we know.
Indeed. And Senator, the difficulty that it seems to me has now been compounded by the way this thing played out is that the president is now talking about climate change agreements in the UN and in Paris. He's talking about perhaps some kind of cyber agreement with the Chinese. I have the feeling that the Senate isn't going to be allowed to be a quality control device on either of those as well. Should that be of concern to all of us, but not least you and your colleagues?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think when you have an executive that knows and recognizes no constitutional constraints, we've got a real problem in this country. And, of course, when you don't have a Senate that's willing to stand up for its rights on a bipartisan basis, I mean, that's what's shocking to me. This is, you know, they all said on the floor how important this deal is. This is the most important consequential vote of their careers, and yet they weren't willing to stand up and say it's so important that, you know, you really should go through the constitutional process of advice and consent and allow the American people, through their elected representatives, have a say as to whether or not this is a good deal or a bad deal. By the way, had that happened, this deal would not be moving forward.
Senator Johnson, let me turn to another topic that I know you've expressed concern about and that may well, again, have a similar kind of course to it, namely President Obama's announced decision to meet with Vladimir Putin next week on the margins of the UN General Assembly. You have been a close student of what Putin is up to. What do you expect will come of those conversations?
Well, I'm afraid what's going to happen is even more capitulation. And it has always concerned me how this administration just refuses to acknowledge reality. I mean, there's a reason this president called ISIS the JV team. He didn't want to have to deal with this. And it's always concerned me how this administration keeps talking about how they want to offer Vladimir Putin off-ramps, where I think any intelligent observer of his behavior would say he's not looking for off-ramps. He's biding his time looking for his next on-ramp. And now we know where his next on-ramps are. It's going to be in Syria, and it's going to be in Baghdad itself. So, Frank, what really surprises me is when you take a look at the combined economic power of the West, over $30 trillion in GDP versus Russia and Iran, less than $3 trillion. They are less than 10% in terms of our global economic strength, and yet look who's pushing who around. It's Iran and it's Russia whose influence is growing in the world, and because of President Obama's strategy of peace through withdrawal, we are becoming more and more weakened and less relevant, which is not a good thing for the world.
It certainly isn't. You add into the mix, as we'll be talking about in the course of the program, the ascendancy of China in parts of the world that are very much of interest to this country as well. And it's open season, it seems, for dangerous sorts and a problem for us, as you say. Senator Johnson, before we run out of time, let me just salute you for your leadership in the Homeland Security Committee of the Senate. On a matter near and dear to our hearts, as you know, we've talked about it before on the program, that is to say the vulnerability of our electric grid. You, of course, had an important hearing on this subject recently and subsequently moved out of the committee something called the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act, and I wanted to thank you for that. Where do you think that stands now with respect to the national agenda and most especially the Senate's agenda?
The first thing we have to do is raise a profile so that people understand that this is a very real threat. You know, we not only had a hearing where we had Dr. Richard Garwin, somebody who worked with Enrico Fermi, and he referred to him as one of the only true geniuses he ever met, testified before our committee. But then I was talking to Secretary Moniz in the hearing on Iran, asking, because he's the Secretary of the Department of Energy, tasked with implementing the recommendations of the EMP Commission. And I was basically ridiculed for even raising the point. So, that's our problem is we do not have the public awareness. But what I'm trying to do is we're also working on a bill where, basically I want this bill to subcontract or be the general contract for providing the capacitors and installing the capacitors in the 200 to 700 very vulnerable transformers we need to just maintain and protect our basic electrical infrastructure. So I'm actually trying to work forward and figure a solution to this thing at the same time while I'm trying to raise the public awareness.
Well, both are absolutely required. We're doing our level best on the public awareness piece, but what you're doing to try to actually move things towards solutions is critically important. I'm very pleased to say that you have a utility up in Wisconsin that's taken the initiative in trying to protect some of those critical transformers in their inventory. But this is the kind of thing that I've got to believe, especially the more we see of the Iranian nuclear ambitions and learn about their desire and capabilities to threaten the grid, to say nothing of Russia, China, North Korea, and others, that your colleagues will resonate to. It's really just a question of do we get to that point in time? And as I say, your leadership on all of these matters, Senator Ron Johnson, is deeply appreciated. Do you have a sense of timing on the Critical Infrastructure Protection Act as a sort of first step? It's an opportunity, of course, to be teaching our American citizenry about this problem, but also to get something done.
Well, my hope is we can just report that out of the Senate and have nobody object to it so we can marry it with the House bill and get this signed into law. But, from my standpoint, we do need to, everybody needs to understand that there's two threats here. It's a high-altitude nuclear blast would be an EMP effect, but you also have geomagnetic disturbances. Both of these are threats. And here's the good news, Frank, is this is testimony from Dr. Richard Garwin. He said for about $100,000 per transformer, we can protect these things from both threats. Now, as we've looked into this, I've heard estimates could be as much as $500,000 per transformer, but that's still 70 to 350 million with an M. You don't even hear federal government projects in millions anymore. They're all billions. So this is something that would be reasonably priced and that go a long way toward really making our electrical grid survivable in the event of either of those threats.
And as you understand so well, Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, the costs to the country of failing to take these steps, should one or the other of these things eventuate, to say nothing of physical sabotage or cyber attack, we would find that money very, very minimal indeed. Sir, we have to let you go, I know. Thank you very much for your time today and for your leadership on all of these issues in the United States Senate. Keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Dr. Derek Scissors joins us. We'll talk about China right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined, I believe, for the first time by Dr. Derek Scissors. Today he is a resident scholar at the highly regarded American Enterprise Institute, where he specializes on matters involving the economies of China and India and their ties to the U.S. financial system. He's the author of two noteworthy books, China in Global Investment Tracker and Chinese Investment in the U.S. Data Set. He also teaches at George Washington University, where he serves as an adjunct professor, focusing again on the Chinese economy. A man of many parts, we're delighted to have him with us. Dr. Scissors, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks for having me.
We are, of course, speaking against the backdrop of the state visit of Chinese President Xi Jinping. I wondered what your take is on the sort of economic conditions that Chinese premier has left behind and what it might mean for his conversations with President Obama.
Well, I think a lot of people are paying attention to the fact that China's been in the news lately, and they hear about Chinese stocks falling and problems with their currency, and they're thinking that China's economy just got into trouble. That's actually not true. China's economy started weakening at least 4 years ago. I would say longer, but my more optimistic friends would agree with at least 4 years ago. So it's been in the headlines recently, but in fact, Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Communist Party, needs to, is coming here with an economy that's been weakening for a while. And they're not going to be able to get out of their problems because they've been building their problems for 7 years or longer for a good long while without very strong action. So he's either coming here distracted because his economy is in trouble and he's really focused on that, or he's coming here with a weak economic hand and he's going to try to divert the talks to something else.
It also would suggest that he's very much in need of the kind of legitimation that President Obama seems quite willing to give him in the state ceremonies on the White House lawn and, of course, the state dinner this evening. Dr. Derek Scissors is our guest. We are speaking about the visit of Xi Jinping, the president of China, Dr. Scissors is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and an adjunct professor at George Washington University and one of the country's leading authorities on the Chinese economy and what it might mean for us, especially for our financial system. Dr. Scissors, you were talking about the extent to which, well, the Chinese president specifically has a weak hand at the moment. Is there any indication that the Chinese government is getting its hands, if I could use that expression, around the kinds of problems that, as you say, have been afflicting their economy for quite some time?
Not really. The previous regime was under Hu Jintao, and they created most of these problems. It was a very badly run economy at the time, and people just didn't see it because economic problems always show up later rather than with the people who caused them. This government recognizes that there are problems, but they're not doing anything. And there's a debate over whether they're not doing anything because they're distracted by the giant political crackdown, which is called the anti-corruption campaign, or they're not doing anything because they don't have the political will to take the actions necessary. There's a fundamental trade-off when you're a communist government, which is the best thing for your economy is to have less control and let the private sector drive your economy forward, which is a reform that China chose repeatedly in the early stages of its reform era. But if you give the private sector more power and more leeway to do what it wants, you give up control. And this government doesn't look like it's willing to give up the control necessary to revive its economy.
Well, and that's really what I wanted to get to is, as you say, it's a badly run economy, but it is state controlled. There's still, as I understand it, quite a considerable influence exerted on the economy by the state-owned enterprises, though to varying degrees, I guess they've gone to some lengths to sort of obscure the degree to which they are both state-owned and state-controlled. But to the extent that the Chinese government does have a way ahead here, is it likely to be enough, given the kind of hole that they've gotten themselves into at the moment, or do they really have to take dramatic steps to liberate the economy, as you say, at the expense of their control?
Well, I mean, if their goal, you know, I'm not one of those guys predicting China's going to collapse economically. A collapse would be a political story. What China's headed for economically is stagnation. And we've seen this all around the world. And the Chinese have a lot of the features of other countries that have stagnated. Their huge labor force is absolutely gigantic. It's now shrinking. So they have fewer workers every year than they did the year before, at least as far as we can tell. They've run up an enormous amount of debt, which probably sounds familiar to everyone listening to the show, but their debt is actually, they've actually run up more debt than we have over the last 7 years, which is really hard, and they've managed to do it. They've hurt their environment very badly, insofar as state-owned enterprises are never allowed to go bankrupt, which appears to be the case. It's very hard to innovate in that environment because there's not enough competition. So if you look at all the sources of growth, they're all weak, and it really will, as you say, require a radical change. Little changes just aren't going to do it. It's just going to postpone the time when China is stagnant. And they just don't seem to have the willingness or the nerve to take those kinds of radical steps, get the state out of the economy, allow people to move wherever they want to so they can get the right jobs. Changes like that seem to be too much for the Communist Party.
Let's talk about the Communist Party for a moment, Dr. Derek Scissors. The degree to which it's just facing stagnation has generally been regarded, as I understand it, as something that would basically doom the communists. And it certainly seems that between some of the considerations you've just talked about, notably the demographic situation, the environmental predations, and just a rising degree of political ferment internally, that the Chinese are facing possibly, you know, revolutionary conditions. And I just wonder, first of all, whether you agree that it could go there, and second of all, whether you would agree with me that that may well give rise to the kind of response that we've seen from totalitarians and authoritarians in the past, which is this so-called social engineering to find external threats to justify the internal repression.
Well, they certainly could do that. I think people have to be aware that the Communist Party has built up a lot of goodwill among ordinary people, which they've eroded. But China in 19... I mean, I'll give a little history here. I don't want to get carried away, but there are still people alive who remember this, and they matter. China in 1977 was unbelievably poor. It was as poor as India was in 1977. Not India now, but India in 1977. It was Bangladesh-level poor. And the party did deliver a lot of important gains in prosperity for ordinary people for a long time. And they survived the challenge after Tiananmen, where there was a lot of social unhappiness. It was a much poorer country back then as well. So, unfortunately, the Communist Party has a lot of staying power. And I think people have to be aware that it's going to take a long time and a number of failures for popular sentiment to really turn against the party. Obviously, there are tens of millions of people or more who are oppressed by the party on a daily basis. But there are hundreds of millions who think the party is the source of stability for China and so on. So I think this is going to have to be a gradual process as long as the party remains unified. I do think there is this threat, as you mentioned, of them looking increasingly outward for distractions. I think this trip is a distraction. Rather than talk about China's economic problems, it's going to be presented as Xi Jinping, one of the world's great leaders, meeting with the U.S., and they're going to try to distract people with that. But if that doesn't work, you know, you could get more aggressive sorts of distractions, and China has some very strange and worrisome territorial claims, and they're an obvious way to get people's minds off economic stagnation.
And potentially put a lot of our minds on the line in terms of the dangers that they represent to our vital interests and those of our allies. It's great to talk with you, Dr. Derek Scissors. I hope this will be the first of many conversations. We wanted to talk a little bit about India, another area of your expertise, and we'll do that on another occasion soon, I hope. In the meantime, keep up the good work at the American Enterprise Institute and also at George Washington University. Next up, we'll talk with another China hand, Dean Cheng of the Heritage Foundation, about cyber warfare and what might come of that in the conversations between our two presidents. More on that straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The imperial presidency was an epithet applied to Richard Nixon's administration. Nixon was a piker compared to Barack Obama. In recent days, Obama has fashioned and jammed through Congress an unsigned, unverifiable, and unworkable deal that assures Iran will get nuclear weapons. Today, he's set to agree with Communist China's dictator Xi Jinping to restrict our economy in the name of curbing global warming and to constrain and possibly expose our cyber warfare capabilities in the preposterous belief that China will do the same. If the precedent of the Obama bomb deal with Iran applies, neither would be subject to congressional quality control. Next week, Obama will meet with his Russian counterpart, with whom he promised he'd have more flexibility. What's next? Our capitulation on Ukraine? Acceding to Putin's military incursion in Syria? Who will stop Obama's dangerous imperial overreach? This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Dean Cheng, a friend and colleague from the Heritage Foundation, where he is a senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center. He specializes there on China's military and foreign policies. He's had a distinguished career in other institutions around town, including Science Applications International, or SAIC. He's also been a senior analyst with the Center for Naval Analysis. It's always good to have him with us, especially to sort of be a bookend for his friend and colleague's conversation with me a moment ago, Derek Scissors. Dean, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I spoke with Dr. Scissors about China's economy, Dean, and one of the things that we sort of teased out was the possible implications of stagnation, as he calls it, in that sphere, for the political circumstances within China, and possibly the slop over into the area that you are most expert in, namely the military capabilities and ambitions of China. Give us a sense of whether you are concerned, as am I, that what China may be doing in response to its internal difficulties, political as well as economic, is manufacturing threats and perhaps provoking conflict outside of China.
Well, I think that certainly as we look at the evolution of China's internal political situation, what we can see is that the Communist Party of China, the CCP, has gone from having what I call has gone from a tricycle to a bicycle to a unicycle. It used to basically base its legitimacy on three things, quote-unquote equality, you know, the old Mao-era shared levels of misery, if you will, to conflate Churchill and Mao, a promise of economic growth so that even if you might not live better, your children would live better, and nationalism, kicking the foreigners out, defending China's borders, etc. Well, equality went out with Deng Xiaoping. China has several hundred billionaires, several thousand millionaires, and millions of people live on $2, $3, $4 a day. The economy is slowing down, and we already have seen efforts to return migrant laborers within China back to their home provinces. So, again, you are seeing, if you are Chinese, a real closing of opportunity, the promise that your children will live better. So what does that leave you? That leaves you now with the single wheel of nationalism. Now, what that means is this is in some ways very, very dangerous because not only does it create an incentive to not compromise, but China also has a very different view of its territory. I think it's important to recognize that from the Chinese perspective, the South China Sea is not Danzig, is not Alsace-Lorraine, it's not somebody else's territory that they are trying to take. From the Chinese perspective, they are defending what they think is theirs. That creates a very different incentive structure, a very different mental attitude than trying to take somebody else's things.
Though there are quite a number of people who think that's exactly what they're doing. Dean, just to stay with the earlier thought, though, and I think that analysis, the historical evolution, is very instructive. One of the things that that Derek was talking about was the Chinese Communist Party still enjoys a lot of loyalty from the Chinese people because it has brought prosperity to so many. You've painted a rather different picture, and it certainly suggests that the external threat, manufactured or otherwise, the need to pull together as a nation against the foreigners may well resonate with lots of Chinese. Given what you know, and you're one of the country's foremost experts on these matters, about the Chinese military buildup that has been taking place in recent years, does this augur for a very dangerous time, in your judgment, perhaps for us, certainly for China's neighbors?
Well, to begin with, I don't think that Derek and I disagree very much at all. I would say that I would agree with him that China, the Chinese people, have certainly come to enjoy a higher standard of living within the lifetime, within the memory of the bulk of the Chinese people, in part because of things that the CCP did. For example, Chinese literacy has gone from, we think, maybe 20% in 1949 to something like 90%, 95% today. So, you know, there is electrification for most of the country, etc. The CCP argues that it is the force that has generated that change. The problem is that you have the challenge of rising expectations. What was good enough to make people happier in 1959 is not going to cut it in 2019. In that situation, the military becomes partly the symbol of accomplishment. Just had the recent 70th anniversary parade through Tiananmen Square with a lot of China's latest military equipment. In a sense, this is a statement to the Chinese people. This is what all that money, all that newfound economic power has bought you. If you are China's neighbors, you look at that, and you should be nervous.
Notably, that missile with the Guam killer on the side of it in English, no less. Yeah, no, that ought to get people's attention. But let me ask you, Dean. Here we have the President of the United States in the aftermath of that parade, and by the way, there was another one that said carrier killer, as I recall. And what has been going on in the South China Sea, and a near miss of an intercept of a U.S. reconnaissance aircraft by a Chinese, as the Chinese president was in the United States. Do you think that the Chinese people are being encouraged to perceive what is going on here as evidence that China is being treated as a superior power by the United States, the tradition of kowtowing by the barbarian to the great Chinese leader.
I'm not sure what the Chinese people are being told. We know that the Chinese media censors an awful lot of information, but I think among the Chinese leadership, that is certainly the image that is being cultivated. The fundamental reality is that we have an administration that is acting against the best advice of its own military. And by administration here, I'm talking about the United States. Admiral Harris, Pacific Command, have apparently said, we want to sail within 12 nautical miles of these artificial islands down in the South China Sea that, because they're artificial, exert no, repeat, no sphere, no 12 nautical mile territorial waters, no EEZ. And in testimony, it turns out that not only is it the White House that has blocked that, but it has blocked it for 3 years. Now, think about that. This is not, look, we have a summit coming up. Let's not roil the waters just before the summit. That happens in repeated administrations. This is a White House that is literally, on the one hand, saying, this, you know, these islands are not acceptable. They send Ash Carter out to Singapore to say, these islands are not acceptable, and then undercut the entire DOD, military, you know, folks in uniform and civilians, by saying, you know, I don't care what you said publicly. I'm not going to let you do it. And the Chinese aren't stupid. They know exactly where we are.
And this almost certainly is being translated by them into a greater and greater sense of a window of opportunity to act against, as I say, our vital interests and those of our allies. Dean Cheng, let me ask you in closing, and we've only got about a minute left, what do you expect out of the conversations between President Obama and President Xi Jinping about cyber warfare?
I think that we are going to see almost nothing. The administration has been running backwards. The claim that there was going to be some kind of cyber confidence building measure. At best, it'll be symbolic, some kind of quote-unquote no first use against critical infrastructure, considering that the Chinese insist that they don't do anything cyber at all. If the administration accepts that, it is just signaling again that China can tell the biggest whoppers out there, and this administration will take them seriously.
I fear you're right on all counts. Dean Cheng, we have to leave it at that for the moment. It's a grim prospect, to say the least, and more grim news may flow from it. But you're covering it brilliantly at the Heritage Foundation. We appreciate your time with us today and look forward to talking with you again. DeRoy Murdoch is up next. We'll talk with him about the Islamic State, Iran, and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by one of the country's most thoughtful and eminent national security and, well, more generally, observers of the scene, shall we say. He is DeRoy Murdoch, a contributing editor with National Review Online. You also see him frequently at Fox News. He has been associated with any number of other programs and networks, and we're delighted to have him with us at ours every once in a while. DeRoy, thanks for joining us. Good to have you back.
My pleasure, Frank.
You've been doing some very important work, notably in your National Review columns. Talk for the moment about one that, especially with the Pope visiting the 9/11 memorial today, ought to be very much front and center on our minds, and that is the connection between the Shiite government of Iran and the various Sunni extremists, jihadists, terrorists, call them what you will, who we're told they couldn't possibly be associated with, notably al-Qaeda. And yet, as you point out, ain't so, and including in the course of the attacks of 9/11 themselves. Talk about that.
You bet. Well, I think this is a misunderstanding. I will confess even I had that. I know Iran has been a very generous supporter of Hamas and Hezbollah and the various terrorist groups which menace and kill Israelis just about every day. But I thought because they are the heart of Shiite extremism that they wouldn't really play ball with al-Qaeda, which of course is a Sunni group. There's a terrific editorial in the Journal, I believe early September, or actually about 2 Mondays ago. And it made the compelling point and provided significant evidence that Iran and al-Qaeda, in fact, are working hand in glove. In fact, the 911 Commission concluded, I'm quoting, there is strong evidence that Iran facilitated the transit of al-Qaeda members into and out of Afghanistan before 9/11, and that some of these were future 9/11 hijackers. So Iran had the people who demolished the Twin Towers going back and forth across its territory. It didn't lock them up. It didn't shoot them. It let them go on and come over here and kill 3,000 of our people. The State Department offered a $10 million reward for a man named Yassin al-Suri for moving money and recruits through Iran. And in fact, the State Department, when it put out that award, said the following: Iranian authorities maintain a relationship with al-Suri and have permitted him to operate within Iran's borders since 2005. And as recently as February of 2014, the Treasury Department revealed that al-Suri, quote, has resumed leadership of al-Qaeda's Iran-based network after being temporarily detained there in late 2011. And there are other quotes that people can find in the piece I wrote about this September 18th on this topic. I think if this information about the incredible links between Iran and al-Qaeda had come out earlier in the debate, not in this Wall Street Journal editorial, which appeared September 14th, I think it was, but say August 14th or July 14th, and the opponents of the Iran nuke deal had focused on this connection between the Ayatollahs and al-Qaeda, I think the American people would have been absolutely disgusted, enraged, and I think we would have been able to kill this deal. Unfortunately, this information came out after the Senate's terrible vote where they refused to disapprove the deal. Mitch McConnell, of course, I think handled that very, very badly, and the information didn't come out soon enough to kill this deal. It is out there now. I hope people focus on it, and maybe even in retrospect, there's something we can do to cripple, if not destroy this, degrade, if not destroy the Iran nuke deal in light of this incredibly important information.
Yeah, you're so right. Of course, the American people were dead set against this deal. But as you say, DeRoy Murdoch, they were not represented very well, certainly in the Senate, Republican leadership, at least. And you've given some thought to what might be done at this point to try to, as you say, degrade, if not destroy, this deal, notably with respect to the immense amount of money. And I think this is the thing that is just so galling to those of us who have a sense of what a country like Iran, the regime there, could do. With $100 billion, let alone $150 billion, and probably more for that matter. What are your thoughts on that point, Dora? Because I think this is a moment when some fresh thinking is required on where do we go from here?
You bet. Well, again, I've not given up on the notion that we can kill this deal. And one way to do it is for the U.S. Congress to send to Obama a spending bill by the end of September, which has all the spending he wants, except for a provision saying that no part of the deal can be used to hand over or unfreeze any of the $150 billion in assets to the atomic Ayatollahs. And if Obama wants to shut down the U.S. government over that, great, let's have this fight. Let's educate the American public on the fact that $150 billion will be going to a vicious regime which held our diplomats hostage, which blew up our Marines in the Beirut barracks, and which continues to engage in all kinds of anti-American and anti-Semitic and anti-Western civilization violence and bloodshed and murder. And if Obama wants to have that fight, great, I think we'll win it, because only 21% of the American public wants this deal as is. And I think the more they learn about the ties between Iran, al-Qaeda, and the notion of sending not just a dollar or two, but $150 billion to this regime, which it can use for more terrorism and more mayhem and more bloodshed from the Middle East all the way to Manhattan to Malibu, I think American people will rebel and say, no, we don't want that. And if we can get Obama to kill that, I think the whole deal falls apart.
It could well. And one of the other points that you've made so well, DeRoy Murdoch, I think in one of your National Review pieces, was this idea that this is happening against the backdrop of the Ayatollahs doing something that even Adolf Hitler didn't do, which is to be completely brazen, both during the negotiations and during the process when Congress was reviewing this deal, about their malevolent intentions, not just towards Israel, but towards our friends and allies and interests in the region and towards us. Quickly, just give us an update on that.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm reading a wonderful book, which was written back in 1940 by William L. Scherer called Berlin Diary. He was CBS radio correspondent. He just talks about life in Berlin in the late 30s, early 40s. And I came across this passage where during the Munich Pact, Neville Chamberlain, of course, went and engaged in appeasement with Hitler. And just before Chamberlain flew back from Berlin to London to announce this agreement, he had one more meeting with Hitler, and they agreed on a joint communique in which Hitler and Neville Chamberlain said the following, that they are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to the assurance of peace in Europe. Nice, warm, fuzzy sentiments. Of course, Hitler then invaded Poland and all that beauty and warmth fell to pieces. But Ayatollah Khamenei doesn't even have the grace to pretend that he has anything that he wants in common with us. He said just, I think, the day before, 2 days before the Senate voted, that we agree to talks with the U.S. only for the nuclear issue. In other areas, we did not allow talks with the U.S., and we will not negotiate with them. So he just completely slammed the door on any further cooperation, which is one of the arguments for this deal, that this would create the opportunity for further dialogue. He said no more dialogue, said we drove the great Satan through the door, and we shouldn't allow it in through the window. So Ayatollah Khamenei did not even rise to the Adolf Hitler standard of
deception.
Post-peace agreement comedy.
And it nonetheless had no impact, apparently, on the 42 Senate Democrats who loyally followed this president down the plank. Let me ask you, DeRoy, very quickly, last comment. You've talked about treating the disease, not the symptom, in terms of this refugee crisis in Syria. Very quickly, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we've spent so much time over the last month or so with these incredibly horrid and tragic images of the refugees leaving the Middle East and landing in Europe, and some of them, I think 100,000 of them are coming our way now. And the whole debate is who takes them, where do they get settled, blah, blah, blah. Look, I think the focus should be here be not like with polio, hey, let's make better wheelchairs. How about we cure polio? Or in this case, go to the root cause of this problem, which is ISIS. Rather than figure out where to send the refugees, how about we make it possible so they don't have to leave in the first place? The refugees can go home, who are already in the West, and that is to kill ISIS, wipe ISIS out, eliminate it, send it to the same place where Adolf Hitler and the Nazis are, which is on the ash heap of history. And if that happens, there will be no need for the refugees to hop on boats, and many of them drown on the way to the West. They ought to be able to stay in their homes where they're very happy, or where they were happy, and we ought to get busy killing ISIS. And unfortunately, this president is engaged in basically cosmetic to ineffective tactics to do so. And there just needs to be a full-out war to demolish ISIS. Like, let's start by destroying their terrorist training camps. We apparently aren't even doing that.
No, we're not. DeRoy, this is a subject for a much longer conversation. I think there's going to be a lot of mess in Syria, even if ISIS is somehow removed. But one thing that does, I think, compel us or should is that you can take care of a lot more refugees in their homes rather than in our country for the same amount of money. We'll be following this closely, as I know will you. DeRoy Murdoch with National Review Online and with Fox News, thanks so much for your time. Come back to us again very soon. Congressman Duncan Hunter joins us next. We'll talk with him about the Boehner resignation and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to have with us one of the men that I admire most in the United States House of Representatives, both for his service in uniform, that of the United States Marine Corps. He served in combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He is today a member of the House Armed Services Committee, a member of the House of Representatives, of course, as well, representing the 50th District of California. He is Congressman Duncan Hunter. I'm very, very glad to have him with us, especially on a rather momentous day, as it turns out. Congressman, good to have a chance to chat with you.
Hey, Frank, thanks for having me on.
Well, we've just heard that your speaker, Congressman John Boehner, is resigning from Congress at the end of October. I know this is, as we speak, new news to you, and don't know whether you've got any insights into why or the circumstances that may translate into in terms of new leadership.
Yeah, in terms of new leadership, everybody's going to be jockeying for position now. The number two guy is Kevin McCarthy, a former Californian, a pretty conservative guy, and so I'm probably going to be supporting Kevin on this thing. But I'll tell you, I think after Speaker Boehner had the Pope out here, he got Bibi Netanyahu to come speak to Congress, then Pope Francis to come speak to Congress. I think that's it for him. He's dealt with some pretty momentous stuff from President Obama's election and then re-election and everything that's gone with that, and the constant struggle and fight for our conservative principles and values. And I think he's done. After Pope Francis came, I think that was his swan song, and he feels like he can leave now, and he has nothing left to accomplish here. Nor is there anything, I don't think, that any Republican speaker can accomplish with a Senate that doesn't have the 60 vote threshold of Republicans to pass House passed bills, and a Democrat president who would pretty much veto anything that we try to get to his desk.
Congressman Duncan Hunter, let me talk about a couple of other things that you've been really on point about. As a Marine, you have, of course, I know, been involved in the controversy that's been swirling around whether the Marines and indeed the other services should be compelled to admit women to all of the combat roles, including ground combat infantry positions, artillery, as you served in, and so on. The Marines have done a pretty rigorous study of this, it seems, and come away with the conclusion that there are some jobs that simply can't be done as well by women as men. And yet the Marines, it appears, are being induced to go with the program of the White House by, among others, Secretary of the Navy. Talk a bit about what is happening here, what the stakes are, and what you think should be done.
Sure. So we put into law, I put into law a few years ago in the National Defense Act that we do every year that funds the military and so forth, that standards have to be gender neutral. So meaning you can't say, hey, we're going to allow women in the SEALs, and by the way, this is the woman's obstacle course and this is the guy's obstacle course. It's got to be the same gender neutral standard for everybody. So that's the first thing, so that the military can't make two standards now. Number two, the Marine Corps did a over 900 page study over, took about a year and tens of millions of dollars, and did a very rigorous study comparing not Marine infantry to women, but non-Marine infantry men to non-Marine infantry women. So meaning it took people that were finance, MOSs, their military occupational specialty could have been supply and motor transportation, and they had integrated units with women, and they studied the units for their combat effectiveness. And what they found was that when you interject women into an all-male squad, your combat effectiveness drops markedly, whether it's how far you can walk, how much weight you can carry, how fast you can set up the machine guns, things like that. What we also find is if you inject men into an all-female unit, you see not the same kind of degradation of ability, but you do see a degradation of ability when you inject men into an all-female unit. So here's what has happened now. Ray Mavis, the political appointee who's former governor of Mississippi, is saying, I don't care what the Marine Corps study says. We're going to have women in the infantry units in the Marine Corps. So politics and gender integration are more important to him in the administration than our combat effectiveness with the military. And he even went so far as to call Marines knuckleheads who do stupid things while off duty, and that should allow for women. I mean, he made some pretty crazy arguments for why he's going to push women in these infantry units. Now, by the way, the Marine Corps, I think, is going to say, look, we're going to allow women in tanks, in artillery, that was my occupational specialty. Everything but the infantry unit, we're in. We're going to comply with what the administration has ordered us to do, except for the infantry, because it degrades the effectiveness of the units, and we can prove it now. So that's what we have. And I think of going forward, Frank, too, this is a congressional issue. Because if you're going to have women as grunts, when you have a draft, my son is almost 15 years old. He's going to sign up for Selective Service when he's 18. My two daughters aren't. So if it's all going to be equal, this is going to take an act of Congress to change our draft rules so that both men and young women have to sign up for the draft at 18 years old. And by the way, we don't draft people to be financial experts in the Marine Corps. We draft people to be grunts in the Marine Corps. If you ever had a draft, it's because we need bodies going after a pillbox on a hilltop in a, you know, some bad place throughout the world. That's why you draft people. So this is more of a congressional issue. I think the administration is doing as much as it can to make the military look like IBM or Google as opposed to the U.S. military right now. But I don't think this is all going to play out prior to President Obama getting out. This is going to take some congressional movements on this to make anything happen permanently.
Congressman, let me turn to one other topic, which I know you've been very concerned about, as I think we all should be. The New York Times recently reported about an appalling subordination of American values and I think, traditions to the conduct of pederasts and child abusers at that, who are our allies in Afghanistan. You've written to Secretary Ash Carter at the Defense Department about this. Talk a little bit about what's at stake here and what you think needs to be done now.
Sure. This entire thing came about because Danny Quinn and Sergeant First Class Charles Martland, we were the two Special Forces guys who roughed up the child rapist Afghan police chief and then are being kicked out of the Army for it. Danny Quinn already got out. But they're actually kicking out the Special Forces sergeant who roughed this guy up for very good reason. And frankly, they only roughed him up. They didn't punch him in the face or anything. They just pushed this bad guy to the ground after finding out that he had chained a little boy to his bed and raped him for 7 days. So they contacted my office saying, why am I getting kicked out for this when this is one of the best things that I've done, frankly, in my entire life? So that's kind of how this story started going. And then a lot more has come out on it, meaning there's a lot more sailor soldiers and Marines that on U.S. bases had to be confronted and had to basically live with Afghan leaders who were raping little boys on U.S. bases. And when our Americans complained about this up the chain of command, they were told this is an Afghan criminal problem, meaning, take another corrupt Afghan police chief that probably does the same thing and have him investigate this. But they were told this is not a military issue. It's a cultural issue, which is disgusting. Because we're over there fighting for American principles and American ideals, and child rape sure as hell is not one of them. So what you have is the Army has lost all common sense in this case. Army leadership has lost common sense in this case. And this started with us trying to help Charles Martland stay in the Army because we think he's the type of person that we want in the Army, not the type of person who should get kicked out.
Congressman Duncan Hunter, I know we're out of time with you for today, but thank you very much for your leadership on all of these issues and more. Keep it up and come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.